Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be fair? In this proudly democratic society, our definitions of fairness can vary, but our belief that it should be a core value has gone largely unchallenged until now. My guest today argues that by conflating fairness with open-mindedness and compassion, we create problems for ourselves and society, and we deny our natural and largely beneficial instincts to take care of our own. Stephen T. Asma is distinguished scholar and professor of philosophy and a fellow of the research group in Mind, Science, and Culture at Columbia College Chicago. His new book is called Against Fairness. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What is fairness and what is the opposite of fairness?
It's a good question to start with because we find that on the left and on the right, there are these two different notions of fairness, I think. In the West, for example, liberals tend to think about fairness as being equal measure, so either equal opportunities or equal outcomes. And of course, if you have equal opportunities, it's hard to measure whether those have been achieved unless you're measuring outcomes. So frequently it's the idea that there should be an equality of wealth or goods or services. On the right, there's sort of the competing notion of fair, which is that sort of a merit-based idea, where the spoils belong to the winner, and this idea runs sort of headlong into the equality notion of fairness, and so we have this debate. We're not even using the terminology, I think, in the same way across the aisle.
Well, it certainly would explain a lot of the disconnect between people on both sides of the aisle that mean well, that want to achieve things. They both say, well, we're working for fairness here, but they're working at cross purposes.
Yeah, it's once you recognize this, it's a little bit funny, it's a little bit tragic, but I think many of us recognize that we would like a society in which people who were disadvantaged had the kind of safety net so that they could flourish and thrive. On the other hand, many of us also have an instinct towards merit, which is if you work hard, you should be rewarded. I had a fairly funny experience with my son in grade school where he came home with a ribbon saying he had won the race. Now, he was in third grade, and I was all excited thinking, oh, he's really fast. He won the race. And he said, no, we all won the race. Everyone that crossed the finish line got the same winner's ribbon. And I thought, well, you can't all win the race. So this was kind of a humorous example of this tension that we have in our thinking.
And what happens there is the only real loser is the person who won on merit.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think here we use the term fair to say, well, everybody gets something, but it's not fair to the winner who ran much faster and worked harder than the other kids. And in our society, we have to be careful that the sort of equality notion of fairness does not completely overshadow the equally powerful and important notion of merit.
So, Stephen, I know that you have one child. I have four. And one thing I've noticed about them is that they are really good at spotting when something has been unfair to them, but they don't necessarily notice the injustice wrought upon their brother or sister. And I wonder if all of us do that, if we really only notice what's unfair when we feel like we are the ones who got the short end of the stick.
Yeah, I think that's right. Some people have pointed out that there's a kind of emotional core to the charge, hey, that's not fair. And the emotional core is this feeling of envy, jealousy. I didn't get what my brother or my sister got. And so this sense of injury is one of the great motivators to our sense of fairness. And when we're using that rhetoric, psychologists have noticed that we're frequently masking this injury that we've sort of perceive ourselves to have experienced. I also think, like, this applies to nepotism as well because, in privileging our family and our friends, a lot of people sort of assume, oh, well, that's automatically corruption because they're sort of looking at it from the point of view of having been disadvantaged or injured somehow. But they frequently forget the times when they were seriously advantaged by nepotism and that kind of preferential treatment was very much to their benefit, and we have this kind of selective attention in the way we talk about things like fairness.
It does leave us with the vexing question of whether we have an obligation to those people that don't have anyone to favor them with nepotism. You know, you think about your kids and mine will be okay because they are being raised middle class and they have educated parents. What about the people for whom there are no advocates?
Yeah, I mean, it is the case that there are people who don't have advocates. It's harder to believe that there are people who have no one that they can call favorites. But even that happens, and that's a sad scenario. On the other hand, I don't think we should build our policies around exceptions like that. We need to make sure that those people are protected. And my argument is that feelings of affection that basically glue us together as a family or as our, I'm going to use the word sort of tribe here in a generic sense to mean just our friends and our and those people we have these affectionate connections with, that feeling of affection can certainly extend out to strangers, and it frequently does. But it's not fairness or the legislation of fair policies or universal sort of application of rules of fairness that get us to help those who are less fortunate. It's frequently philanthropy or feelings of philanthropy, and that is the same kind of emotional experience that we have towards our own families. We're just extending it, you know, and sort of we're experiencing a interesting time in the calendar, which is Christmas season, where you're frequently reminded, you're sort of given this kind of Good Samaritan trigger to think about strangers who are less fortunate than you. And many, many Americans do. They step up and they feel sympathy and empathy for those less fortunate, and then they help them. But it's not from this egalitarian notion of fairness that that good philanthropy comes from.
I want to go back for a minute to this issue of envy, which you brought up earlier. This is something that humans have likely experienced since humans have existed. And yet, you know, we know that people were sort of told to suck it up. You know, it's one of the seven deadly sins. When did we get to a point where envy became so intolerable that rather than saying, I shouldn't feel this way, we decided that we should simply relieve our envy by getting whatever it is we covet?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you put it, I think, correctly. That there's some historians of the American family have pinpointed this as happening sort of starting at the turn of the 20th century, and it getting stronger, of course, after the Second World War, and you had this, you know, huge jumps in prosperity. And what they noticed was that if you look at 19th century American stories, sort of how to raise your children, there's frequently the suggestion that you should teach your kids to suck it up when they don't have something they want. And as you move forward into the 20s, 30s, and certainly by the 50s, the whole language of parenting has changed. And the suggestion there is, if you're going to buy one of your kids, you know, a nice hat or a toy, make sure you get the same or something similar or of equal value for all the other kids. Otherwise, this envy will rear its head, and you'll end up with this kind of chaotic, you know, misery amongst your children. And the best thing to do is to sort of nip that in the bud right away by distributing, you know, the gifts equally. So it has been a recent change, I think, in how we think about raising our children. And my own sort of argument in the book is that it's probably not helping in terms of shaping our children's character to give them whatever they want when they want it, because you end up with a fairly, you know, spoiled generation, and you also end up with kind of characters who are sort of like teacups. They break easily. They become wounded too easily. And I think it's almost better for us to reconcile ourselves to the unfairness of life, because it helps build character.
And of course, you're not suggesting that parents, you know, pick a clear favorite and every time sort of favor child.
No.
But it does make sense. You know, you get to the workforce, and it's not like everybody gets a promotion today. Everybody gets a raise. It doesn't work that way.
That's right, and I'm a college teacher. I grade students' papers. I don't give them all a good grade just because I want to be nice or because I feel like that's the fair thing to do. There's a whole range from A to F, and I try to apportion that, you know, in a just manner. So I don't think about fairness when I'm grading. I don't think companies think about fairness with regard to salaries. They think about merit, and they think about excellence and how to reward it and how to encourage it. And I think that's an aspect of our culture that we still prize this, and you see it in things like the Olympics, and we have this kind of taste for singing competition reality shows where excellence is rewarded. But also in our official dialogue, we still like this idea of equality for everyone.
It is odd that we live in a society that so prizes fairness and also prizes competition. And they're not mutually exclusive, but they do come in conflict occasionally.
They do. And I actually think it's not clear, you know, that you can resolve this, you know, by going to one side rather than another. I think we're going to always have to have a dialogue between these impulses. They're sort of parts of our psyche, and they sort of have shaped the American experience. And then on top of it, I think I'm arguing in my book for a kind of favoritism that is hard to reconcile with both these things. Because if your favorites, you know, you think about your family members or your best friend, that they don't get your affection because they're the most excellent human beings, you know. You know, they haven't merited it. You have affection and history with them, and so you privilege them, but not because it's the fair thing to do, or it's not even because they're that amazing as human beings. It's because of something else, basically love and affection. And this is also hard to square with these other notions of fairness.
And you note in the first chapter that even Jesus had favorites. And this is a figure that we associate with tolerance and a sense of compassion. But those things, you say, are not mutually exclusive at all.
Right. Yeah, I think Jesus is usually held up as one of the people who could apply love in the most egalitarian fashion. You know, he was hanging out with tax collectors and prostitutes and, you know, the outcasts, and thought that we should extend our, you know, our love in a sort of universal way. But it's interesting that most scholars think that John was his favorite, although we're not entirely sure. It does say in the Gospels that he had a favorite disciple. And he even had a three-man inner posse inside the 12 disciple posse. And so I looked at this in the book, and also other examples, like in Buddhism you have the same thing. It's pretty clear to me, at least, that having favorites is human. It's part of human nature. You can't do otherwise. Even the saints like Jesus and Gandhi couldn't help but favor some people over others. And my argument in the book is, you know, what's wrong with this? This is entirely, you know, we're sort of taught not to do this, but really it's part of who we are as human beings. And it turns out that things like compassion, generosity, and having an open mind are every bit compatible with favoritism as they are with fairness. Many people are extremely generous to their inner circle, their tribe, their family. They'll give away everything they have. It's not that they're selfish if they don't love everybody or care about everybody. They can be extremely generous, but it's going to be they're sort of going to be giving these preferences to a small number of people in the family. And also, I think it's increasingly clear from psychological experimentation that it's entirely possible to have in-group devotion towards your family or your clan or your tribe, and also not necessarily be hostile to outgroups. And that was a sort of long-time thought. You're either with us or against us. It's us versus them. And it looks like our psychology is a little more nuanced and interesting than that.
Stephen T. Asma is my guest. He's distinguished scholar and professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of the new book, Against Fairness. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen T. Asma. He is Distinguished Scholar and Professor of Philosophy at Columbia College Chicago. His new book is called Against Fairness. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Stephen, when you talk about the ability to sort of privilege your in-group without necessarily feeling bad about it and without necessarily doing bad things to the out-group, I mean, I think instantly into many people's heads pops the question of racism and the sense that one group that is on top that doesn't make an effort to sort of extend its reach will remain on top in a way that is unjust. Can you talk about how this all squares with your ideas about fairness?
Yeah, I think, of course, racism is basically an indefensible kind of tribe. And I think historically it's true that people have seen themselves as part of this group or that based on things like skin color or ethnicity. Also, obviously, things like religion and, of course, more recently, nation states. And my argument is not designed to justify any of this. I'm very much against all of these forms of tribalism. And I'm against them for the sort of obvious reasons that a little bit of rationality and experience tells us that these are the most sort of artificial ways to carve human beings up into bogus groups. And there's nothing about race or skin color or ethnicity that is somehow essential in separating people, and that human nature goes sort of beyond these categories. So my argument is that we're all going to have tribes, and we're all going to have sort of favorites and cliques in this way, but we can educate those tribes and our tastes for tribes, and we can sort of have better and worse tribes. I lived in Cambodia for a while where there was a terrible, genocide there, and I also spent time in Rwanda where there's another genocide, and you see there that tribalism can be extremely stupid, and things like media and old histories of racism can be used to justify all kinds of violence between us and them, and we frequently have this tendency to demonize others. We have to educate ourselves so that this is not the kind of tribe that is acceptable. What is the kind of tribe that's acceptable? Well, it's those people for whom we feel affection, love, have experience and history with. But it turns out that human beings can fish those people from a very wide pool, a very diverse pool. And again, psychology has shown us through experimentation that human beings are able to find sort of tribal affiliation almost trivial sort of criteria. For example, many people feel close to each other if they like the same sports team, and we all recognize this is true. Even really arbitrary stuff like if you like the same kind of music, you feel like you're part of the same kind of tribe. So the tribe is a very flexible, porous kind of social group, and I'm arguing that we should try to have the most enlightened versions of this that we can. And so I believe in the liberal, small L liberal sort of ideals of tolerance and progress in that sense.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Bill in Dallas, Stephen, that I'm sure will interest you. Bill says, please assess the complicity of our consumer society in the rise of fairness over the past 60 years.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think consumerism has exploded, obviously. It's been with us a long time, but we have sort of new means by which to sort of target our tastes and our many appetites for material things and experiences. And I think it's interesting that fairness should develop to such a high fever pitch in correlation with consumerism. So we think about the good life as Americans today, in terms of, well, what do we have? What do we own? And then it becomes a very simple step to, well, he has more than I do, or she has more than I do. And then we're measuring our notions of success in terms of the consumer model. And so I, you know, as a philosopher, I look at this and I think, you know, this was a disastrous step on our part, but we're deep into it now. How do we, you know, what do we do about it? And I think the language of fairness and the idea that we should have equal material goods is only furthering this confusion about what the good life is. And previous generations and different eras certainly didn't think about the good life as the acquisition of wealth. And if we could sort of educate ourselves better in terms of ethics and think about the good life as being much more rich than this, and replace ideas like fairness and equality of wealth with bigger ideas like justice and, you know, human flourishing, I think we could get away from the kind of rat race that many Americans find themselves in. You know, we just had Black Friday after, you know, Thanksgiving, and it's always a kind of embarrassing thing to watch people
trampled at Walmart. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I think if we didn't measure our own success in terms of our material wealth, who's got the latest gadgets and devices, we'd all be better off. And I think that fairness is, unfortunately, the wrong criteria. I think it feeds into this consumer model too much.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Henry in the Colony. Hi, Henry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I think about these things, it seems my brain always goes back to the notion that there's just too many people in the world, and obviously we know that it's getting worse by the day. The thing that came to mind was when I'm a white person, you know, in the checkbox, and when I was applying for grants and loans in college, well, I was, you know, I didn't have any money. My parents didn't have any money, but I wasn't allowed to access to some of those, you know, programs or funding or grants or loans just because I had to check the white box. And, you know, it invokes the notion of fairness. Well, there's just too many people, so it's almost like it's impossible to give everyone a fair shake, and I understand that. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think Henry raises an important point. If you have a small society, some of what I say perhaps seems more reasonable. And when you scale it up to the kind of level we're at now, do you need notions of fairness? You do. Can you satisfy all notions of fairness? No, I think Henry's right. You can't. Having said that, though, there are other ways to evaluate something like, you know, he was saying ticking off the boxes in applications. Let's say, you know, if you look at sort of the affirmative action case with regard to universities and employment and that kind of thing, you know, the way to think about it, from my point of view, is not so much about fairness, but what is just, what is good for the society, what is good for the health of the society. And I think if you look at traditional affirmative action, if you look at Johnson-era affirmative action, which was based on making sure that the descendants of slaves had some preferential treatment because of their impoverished state and their history, you'll find that I think most Americans would agree, you know, that, well, that was a great, great idea. What's happened, however, is that community has not been served well, especially more recently, by affirmative action, and many people on the right and the left have criticized it, affirmative action, on the grounds that, well, people, sort of middle class and even wealthy people of color from all around the world are now getting into the schools, and then, you know, that's not what it was originally set up for. So is it like a reverse kind of racism? But I think what Henry points out is you could easily tinker with affirmative action and make it, instead of being race or ethnically based, you could make it economically oriented so that those people, white or black or whatever ethnic background, were economically underprivileged, they could find themselves now preferentially treated. And I think many of us would agree that that is helpful to the larger society in addition to the individuals that would profit from it.
Okay, so let's talk about small groups and how our favoritism there might widen out. I'm thinking, for example, of people who You know, parents who favor their kids, of course, you know, want to give them a winter coat and an education that they don't do for the people next door. But how do you keep that favoritism in check so that those same parents don't go into, you know, the soccer coach's office and say, I want my kid to start even if that child is not qualified?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't have a universal rule that or a criterion that would just sort of solve this problem, because it's like a matter of degree, like you said. Every parent wants to give their kid certain advantages. They want their kid to do well, and they'll go to all kinds of extremes. But then it shades into these more obnoxious forms of bullying people, you know, so that their kid will get the most lines in the school play or get to play on the field more in the game. And I think many of us sort of know it when we see it. That's an abuse of favoritism.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I myself was fairly egalitarian-minded until my son was born, and then I did have very new kinds of emotions, like, oh, my God, you know, I would totally go to the wall and do whatever it took for my own son to do well in life. And I realized there was almost no boundary to that. And that's a scary thing, but, you know, most parents at least recognize that emotion. So now the question is, okay, how do we temper that so that we're not just obnoxiously pushing our kids down everybody's throats as the best? And I think it just has to be done on a case-by-case basis. You can't just push people around. On the other hand, you know, there's a great story that Confucius tells. He says Confucius went out to this outlying region, and he runs into a local politician there, and the politician wants to impress Confucius, and he says, you know, here in our town, we're so righteous and virtuous that if a father steals a sheep, the son will give evidence against the father. And Confucius thinks about this for a minute, and he sort of scratches his head, and he says, well, where I come from, the son shields the father, and the father shields the son. We call that virtue. And so no more is really said about this case, but it did stick in my head, and I thought, you know, yeah, what are the lengths to which we will go to protect our own? And I think this is one of the things we really like about gangster movies and, you know, the various Cosa Nostra TV shows that we see about the mafia, is you see, like, a really intense loyalty ethic inside the family. And then you see this amoral behavior on the outside of the family. And so I think that is really the aspect that we're interested in and we're drawn to, but we don't know how to negotiate it exactly.
Yeah, and you know, the opposite to that story is the story of the Madoff brothers, who sort of got together and said, we can't let our dad keep doing this, after they discovered what was taking place.
Right, yeah. I think many people recognize that there's a limit to this, and you don't just protect your sibling or your parent if they are in fact harming people, you know, right and left. You know, we have to sort of understand our loyalty within the context of that larger social ethic.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Barbara on the line now in Austin. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, I am a Dallasite placed in Austin, and I just miss you terribly. Anyway, I'd just like to comment that although I agree with you about the need for healthy competition among kids and in the world, I think we have to kind of take responsibility for those less fortunate, not out of emotion, because emotions are whimsical and you can't count on them. We might feel very good at Christmas time to help somebody, but what happens the rest of the year? So I think we need some legislative or some rules or something to sort of make us help other people, because I think the preferential treatment that we give our families and our children are an extension of our own survival, which is prime, you know, prime instinct in a sense, whereas we don't feel that same way with other people. But there are people who are less fortunate who don't have the opportunities we have, and I think we need more help in helping them, you know, coming around consistently and helping them. I think our major problems come with monitoring distribution and following up. That's always the hard part.
Barbara, thank you so much for your call. And Stephen, I guess therein lies everything that Congress has been arguing about for about the past 15 years.
Yeah, that's right. No, I think Barbara raises an excellent point. There's this tension between whether we think about ethics and morality is based on emotions or on rationality and principles, and I think Barbara is sort of siding with rational principles because emotions can be problematic. And I respect that point. Emotions can be fleeting. They can change. I guess I take the position that that's probably where our real ethical sort of convictions lies, in the emotions. And this is part of a long philosophical tradition that goes back to the sort of the Enlightenment and people like David Hume and Adam Smith. And their idea was, well, we have feelings, and the trick is to train the better feelings, like empathy and compassion, rather than feelings like jealousy, envy, hate, anger. So we have, sort of have all the animals of the barnyard sort of in us, in our psyche, and the trick in education is to cultivate the really positive, the sort of pro-social emotions. So in that sense, I think that the emotions are enough if they're educated properly. But I do agree with Barbara's point ultimately that if people are not surviving or flourishing in a sort of ethics that's emotionally based, then we will probably have to have laws that protect. And I'm all for sort of basic welfare state sorts of policies, in the sense I don't think any American should be starving or homeless. I do believe that that's a matter of public policy. But I'm also trying to isolate that there's this whole realm of moral conviction that we have that is very preferential and favoritistic, if I can sort of invent a word here, and that our culture doesn't have a lot of, we don't talk about it very much.
So it's there, we just pretend it's not.
Right. We act, if it comes up, it gets treated like it's some kind of embarrassing feature of who we are, like, you know, I would never prefer, you know, people act like, well, nepotism is just automatically corruption. And what I'm suggesting is we should sort of celebrate these connections more, even if I think we also need sort of policies and principles to protect the less fortunate.
Stephen T. Asma is my guest. He's distinguished scholar and professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago. His new book is called Against Fairness. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU's certificate program in financial planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen T. Asma. He is distinguished scholar and professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of the new book Against Fairness. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stephen, to the extent that favoritism is practiced and acknowledged for what it is in some other countries, why is it that we in the United States seem to struggle with this notion in a unique way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it has to do with how we the American psyche was born kicking its way out of monarchies. And so we have a unique hostility to authority that you don't find, for example, in Chinese culture. I lived in China for a while and studied Chinese culture. Here in the States, we think, and other sort of intellectuals have noticed this, even historically. Alex de Tocqueville noticed this, the sort of French philosopher, when he toured the United States. He said, you know, Americans are uniquely sensitive to authority, and we resist the idea. We have this kind of you're not the boss of me mentality at bottom, and when we see somebody trying to sort of impose on us, we resist it. At the same time, we like to think, well, nobody will be better than us. We will have the same amount that everyone else has. And in that sense, that celebration of equality has translated into wealth and goods and that sort of consumer notion that we were talking about before. So that's the kind of history of our country that makes us quite different. That's a difference really between the West and the East that goes back even before the States. The Chinese think about morality as being primarily based on the family. They think about, they have this notion called filial piety, which means like your family devotion. Mm-hmm. So the way in which you learn how to be a good citizen or member of society is you understand your place as, you know, the firstborn son or the secondborn or the daughter or the parent or the grandparent, and you understand your role in that family dynamic, and you always give favorite preferential treatment to the family, and then favor goes out sort of in concentric circles from that nuclear group. And that's just a different way in which we think about ethics. We think about ethics like it's a series of laws that applies to everybody in a universal way. And that was sort of developed in the Constitution. Our founding fathers believed that ethics was sort of like a science. And in the same way that Newton had a law of gravity that applied to every physical body, we could have a sort of law of fairness and egalitarianism that would apply to all human beings equally. So a huge difference between the East and the West and how we even think about morality and fairness.
I wonder if some of our preaching about fairness, Stephen, might have to do with the fact that, boy, there's nothing we Americans love better than to view ourselves as individuals who have pulled ourselves up from our own bootstraps rather than acknowledging, you know, the good fortune to be born with, you know, to parents who have resources or who are together or who have education. If we admit that there is some favoritism in the world, we also have to admit, many of us, that we had some help.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there's a general hostility towards people who have been born into privilege and then attained, you know, these high levels without ever sort of working for it. And we've sort of married together these impulses by Americans sort of want the equal opportunity with everyone else to eventually become better than everyone else, which I just think is a funny sort of marriage of our, you know, our sort of desire for equality and our desire for hierarchy and superiority.
Right.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have David on the line now in Atlanta. Hi, David.
Hello. Hi. Thanks. You have a great show. I always enjoy listening.
Thank you.
Your guest sort of brushed aside affirmative action earlier. In his comment where he said something to the fact that, well, now that, you know, affirmative action is benefiting people in middle and upper class and so on, but the issue of giving people, you know, providing opportunities for people, whether they're people of color or women, equal access or opportunities is still a major challenge because, to your point earlier, you keep saying that we tend to favor the people that we're around. So if you have a group of all men, all white male or all black males or all Hispanic males, they're all going to tend to hire their own people, their own kind. There is still a need. So there's no issue. The need to address those issues still exists regardless of the class level because, you know, you have a lot of people of color and women who are still struggling to get in at different levels simply because they're not part of that group.
What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I recognize that point. And I think it goes back to my earlier claim that we need to have much more sophisticated ideas about our tribal affiliations. They can't break down according to just gender or race. And I admit David's point that historically that's been the case, and so that is something that has to be worked against. I was simply pointing out that something like affirmative action could be changed according to how we decided you know, what was best for the society in terms of sort of social justice ideas, and we didn't need to appeal to sort of ideas about fairness. In fact, I think fairness is a bit of a blank cartridge here, because which is, if you apply the idea of fairness to affirmative action, well, what's more fair? You privilege people who have previously been discriminated against because of skin color, or you go totally colorblind on this and nobody gets any partial treatment at all. Fairness seems to capture both those scenarios, and so I don't think fairness is very helpful. What we do What we can do is think about social justice issues. And I do think it's correct that people who are underprivileged, whether it's for economic or racial reasons, do deserve preferential treatment, and I would be able to justify that on the grounds of this larger notion of social justice. If you look at President Obama, for example, he said famously, well, look, my daughters don't need affirmative action. And of course he was right, because he's of a certain kind of class and economic status. Does that mean no people of color need affirmative action? No, that's not what he's saying, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that, those policies can be measured in terms of larger social health, not fairness.
Is favoritism less ethically acceptable if it comes tied to expectations of eventual reciprocation? Is it less okay to give things to the people we favor if we do so thinking, well, somewhere down the line, this person will do something back for me?
I suppose there's a sense in which our allegiance probably evolved as part of this sort of reciprocity system. Like, I definitely scratch your back, you scratch my back.
Right.
We see that in primates, we see that in social mammals, and no doubt this evolved as a way in which, you know, individuals could work within groups, and then the whole group would have a greater survival advantage given, you know, evolving in a hostile world. On the other hand, I think the human beings are able to go way beyond that. We have, you know, this amazing huge brain that evolved, you know, within the last 250,000 years, and we've sort of moved beyond. Even though we're very much tied to the animal kingdom, in some sense, we're able to do things for the good of the other person, not just because I'm going to get something back from this. And I suppose even here as I'm talking, there's a kind of model for this among other animals too, and I'm thinking about mothers who invest a tremendous amount in their offspring and rarely get it back. In fact, it ends up being a liability, all of the energy and resources they put into their offsprings. Also, I've recently learned that the mothers of boys die younger than the mothers of daughters, just a little factoid for you. But it's an interesting point. It's clear that human beings, and I'm suggesting other mammals too, have the ability to sort of work very hard and give in a very sort of favoritist way, even when they're not going to get anywhere near that kind of payback return to them.
What do we do about advantages that are not tied to merit, and they're not necessarily, but they come anyway? And you've written about this, the idea that beautiful people have lots of kind treatment simply because they're nice to look at, I guess.
Yeah, I guess some people call this the halo effect, where if you're attractive, you know, doors open for you, and the way is smoothed for you in life. And it's pretty obvious that this is true. I guess my argument is, you know, since I've written against fairness, I'm sort of maybe by implication sort of for this kind of thing. And I guess what I want to say is people do get preferential treatment for all kinds of reasons. One of them is because, you know, you happen to be related to the person. Other reasons could be just you're attractive, you're physically attractive, or you're more charismatic. And I just feel like I don't think we should hold that against people. This is sort of my critique of the envy engine that I find in a lot of, you know, cries of unfairness. We should sort of, you know, admit that this is happening, get over it, accept it. What are we going to do, like legislate against attractiveness and try to prevent people from looking, you know, more attractive than others? We certainly can't live in that world, so we have to sort of resign ourselves to it and make it a part of our understanding of the way the world works. So I guess nothing's going to change on that front, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. It has occurred to me that supermodels should not be allowed to use makeup, and people like me should be allowed, and maybe that would level the playing field, but that's my own issue, and we'll discuss that some other time. Let's go to the phones one more time. We have Tim on the line in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey there. Thanks for just quick. You guys are close to the end.
You know, it always seems like in the arguments that take place, whether you're looking at Congress and government and all the rest of that, the argument of helping one another seems to really focus around the idea of things, whether it's, you know, my stuff, giving it to someone else who might not deserve it or who worked for it as hard as I did, or money or all the rest of that stuff. What always seems to be missing, at least as far as what I can gather, is the idea of giving someone your time or your effort or your ideas, if you will. And so I wonder, in thinking about that, about the idea of, you know, instead of having, you know, a point in someone's life, let's say after college or after high school, that you have to go and serve your country from a military standpoint, which I know we don't have here, but the idea of having, you know, kind of a standard amount of time that someone goes out and serves their community, whether their community is their country or their community as a whole, as it surrounds them geographically, and maybe that might increase the idea of empathy rather than sympathy, because sympathy seems to me a harder thing to be able to kind of goad people into acting on in terms of giving stuff away. Thoughts?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, no, Tim raises a very good point. In the book, I also try to follow up on that, which is, you know, we do think in terms of things and the distribution of things, and that's very convenient for a fairness system. But, of course, as he pointed out, there's the giving of one's time. I like the idea that he was suggesting there. I think that would be very healthy at the larger social level, and it would improve our understanding of each other to have sort of walked a mile in each other's shoes in that sense. I also think the we're oftentimes sharing our abilities and skills with each other, not just things. And these kind of relationships, which I call the apprentice-master relationship, they're increasingly hard to find in our culture. And I'm sort of suggesting that that's one of those relationships that can only happen if you're sort of if you have favorites or you are a favorite, because it requires a great deal more investment on both parties, the apprentice and the master. And instead, education has gone the route of institutionalized sort of everybody gets the same amount of time, gets the same worksheets and that kind of thing. And what I'm suggesting is we've lost something by having that notion of kind of a uniform utilitarian education. And there's aspects of the sharing of time that really can only happen in these small favorite sort of tribal groups.
Have your students learned not to come to you and say, but Professor Asma, that's not fair?
Yes, they'll still try. I think they recognize that they're going to get the grade they deserve. And that's frequent. And I was sort of talking about this in the book, too. It's funny that in the American educational system, I'm not allowed to post anyone's grades. Like, no one can see each other's grades. That would be a violation of their privacy. I'd probably lose my job. But it's funny that in China, everyone gets their grades posted. So you see your name and you see the grade you got, and everybody sees it posted in the hallway. And I thought this was kind of a big difference between American and sort of Eastern ideas about education and fairness.
A little shame goes a long way.
Right.
Stephen T. Asma is Distinguished Scholar and Professor of History and a Fellow of the Research Group in Mind, Science, and Culture at Columbia College Chicago. His new book is called Against Fairness. Stephen, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.